It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could be here. So board games, they have evolved from simple pastimes to these strategic competitions with high levels of complexity. And this trend is expected to continue, according to market research group SkyQuest, forecasting a global value of the board game market hitting almost $31 billion over the next 6 years. We explore the Wisconsin thread in this industry. Join in on Board Game Development, 800-642-1234. Stanislav Kordonsky is a Milwaukee-based creator of several tabletop games, including new ones out this year, Lockup Breakout, Endless Winter, and Resurgence. He founded Half a Kingdom Games. It's a consulting firm helping game developers. Stan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's glad to be here. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you have several of these games scheduled for release this year. Lockup Breakout out now. Where do your ideas come from for these games?
A lot of my ideas just simply come from me either finding a topic that I'm interested in, or maybe seeing a movie or reading a book and thinking that it's a very interesting subject. Or playing other board games and seeing kind of either missed opportunities or seeing sort of a niche that has not been explored. And then I usually would start with that as my beginning of my ideas.
It's interesting because someone would say, well, reading a book, you could see that book on the big screen as a movie, but you can see when you're reading a book how it might be applicable to being a game.
Yeah, it's sort of, I think it comes from just years and years of playing board games and seeing concepts that can be transferred into a board games. Obviously, not all concepts can be transferred into a board game form successfully, but lots of them can. Especially board games are good at representing things like simple economic concept, a simple war concept, area control concepts, things of that nature. So if I find a period in history maybe or some other item that I think, oh, well, this is unusual, then I would think on it a little more and see if that would be a fertile ground for a board game in the future.
I wonder, how do you know when to walk away from a particular design that you might really love, but it's just not working? Or when do you put it on the shelf for a while and let it go?
Yeah, I try to sort of edit myself and make sure I don't spend too much time on projects that aren't panning out. But it is hard because it is a work of passion as well as a business. So if I'm really passionate about a project, sometimes I will work on it way beyond what's reasonable. And I guess you would call it a cost of doing business in a creative sort of field where I would pursue something sometimes for a couple of years or longer before I put it on the shelf. And even then, I can't say completely ever goes out of my mind. I would still sometimes think about it and maybe even go back to it for a short period of time. It's hard to do it because a lot of my games are passion projects. They aren't simply products that I'm making for the market, but they're things that I'm truly passionate about.
Well, let's go way back. You immigrated to the U.S. from Crimea, Ukraine, in 1997, discovered board games, I understand, here. What was your experience playing games as a kid in Ukraine?
We had access to some mass market games or some, you know, bootleg games occasionally. My uncle had a copy of Monopoly that was in Polish language. And I played with it. I didn't play the game, but I played with the game because I couldn't understand what was written. But it looked so exciting with all the pieces and paper money and cards. And it was a mysterious thing to me. So I was sort of experiencing these games as toys almost. Then later on, I got to play Russian language versions of popular games like Risk and some other such kind of mass market items. But we were not aware that there was a whole world of sort of these heavier hobby board games or role-playing games. At least where I lived, we weren't aware because I hail from a smaller town. You know, I didn't live in a large perhaps people in the larger cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg and Kiev were aware at that time, but we certainly weren't. So that was my experience, a sort of very mass market, very kind of an odd approach, I guess. But even then, it sort of touched something in me, and I was just extremely drawn to that genre.
I wonder if games helped you as a kid transition to a new world, to a new land.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I found a group of people. My first group of, I would say, English-speaking friends was from the people that I met through playing board games. I wandered into a local board game store and found a reception to be very warm. And I am still in touch with these folks. So these are the guys I met in 1997, so quite a bit ago. And many of them were still in touch, even though many of us don't live in this area anymore. Mm. But it was definitely a force to sort of unite people and get people to be accepting to each other.
We're talking about the world of creating tabletop board games with game designer Stan Kordonsky of Milwaukee. You can join in on game development ideas you've had, 800-642-1234. You mentioned the money of trying to create these games. And, you know, there's a lot that has been crowdfunded for game design. There was Dicebreaker that said crowdfunding platform Kickstarter generated $146 million for tabletop game developers last year. What does that mean for this creative industry and your experience trying to get a game off the ground?
Well, it's a highly competitive environment, to be sure. There is a large demand. The industry is growing as far as the total number of money spent on games, but it's still very much a sort of a buyer's market where consumer has the power because they have so many choices. There's a game for everyone and the game about anything. So you really are pushed to make a unique quality product. So I think it drives sort of ingenuity and quality right now in the industry, where you constantly try to come up with something innovative and also deliver things that are just a quality produced, attractive product. So they both ideas and execution, physical, you know, illustration, miniatures, whatever the case may be. So I think it's a great time to be a board game enthusiast because your choices are very large and the publishers and designers are very motivated to give you the absolute best thing that they can.
It's amazing, you know, if there are 1,000 new board games released every year, that, you know, that's a huge mass of board games. That's a very crowded field. How do you gauge the success of a game with that much competition out there?
You know, you can look at the number of backers you have on Kickstarter that back your project or the number of units sold over time or how long the game stays in. I mean, all of those are important metrics. But yeah, in this environment, just simply making a game that can stick around. You know, one of my first games I designed was Dice Hospital and Lock Up. And those games are still around since about 2016, I think, or 2016, 2017, respectively. And so that's a pretty good milestone in the board game industry because games that aren't good enough, you know, they just kind of disappear, they fizzle out. So I look at a longevity of a game and trying to see if that was something that really resonated with people, because the game that did resonate, it tends to stay around a little bit longer and gather a little bit more momentum. But it's virtually impossible to corner this market right now. So that's not really the goal here. Like I said, the goal is just to make the best possible thing that I can make and then let it sort of speak for itself and let the product get its own fans. People who experience it will want to experience it again and will tell others about it. And this sort of grassroots marketing, grassroots kind of advertising is what I'm going for. So I work more with a sort of a personal experience and kind of word of mouth, social media type campaigns.
Tabletop board game creator Stan Kordonsky with us on how games come to market, what it takes to make one. Join in on what keeps you engaged on board games, ones you keep coming back to, your approach to teaching someone how to play. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's for the love of board games and how they come to fruition. Game developers have leaned into crowdsourcing through Kickstarter. And case in point here, Dark Tower, originally published by Milton Bradley in the early 80s, a company called Restoration Games did just that with Return to Dark Tower, raising over $4 million from almost 24,000 backers. Join in on tabletop games, ones you want revived, 800-642-1234. Milwaukee-based board game creator Stan Kordonsky stays with us. So, Stan, several publishers distribute your games, and your website also has ideas for more games without a publisher yet. What is that matchmaking like? How do you try to get publishers to consider your games?
It usually starts with just making a quality game first. Once I have a game that I feel like is good enough to even, you know, show people, I start working on it with a close group of people. Called play testers, and I get it to a shape where it starts being quite good. At that point, I start reaching out to publishers that have either published similar games in the past or have something that may be close to what I've made. And then I start pitching these ideas to them, sending them emails. You know, if they're interested, I have my games on Tabletop Simulator, which is a virtual platform where I can play a custom-made board game remotely with someone via internet. And that helps a lot because I can connect with people all over the world. I have connected with people in the UK, in Greece, and elsewhere. And It's a lengthy process to be sure. Usually a lot of people won't be able to take your game on for various reasons. But eventually, if the game is good and if you're persistent enough, then you start getting interested people sort of return your email discussing the possibility of publishing the game. And eventually it leads to making an agreement with them and the game being license to that company. That's sort of the bird's eye view of the process.
Well, in the world then of playtesting, as you call it, how do you try these games out on real people, people who haven't played the game before? How do you teach someone one of your games?
Well, I try to not torture my playtesters with extremely raw or underdeveloped ideas. I try to make sure that the game is at least decent. My wife is very good at sort of seeing my initial ideas and at least telling me like, hey, that's pretty raw, or hey, that's not, doesn't seem to be very good. So she gets exposed to a lot of my early ideas. Once I feel like it's good enough, then I would approach people. And I have a group of people over the years. I've built these relationships with these people who are either my personal friends or maybe other local people who are trying to become game designers. So it's an exchange of ideas, exchange of time, where I will play test their ideas, they will play test my ideas, and we go back and forth collaborating and cooperating there. So it's a lot of give and take. In that industry, it's not like I have a staff that comes to work and has to play my games, but it's more of a free flowing sort of a friendly marketplace.
And thank goodness for the internet, I imagine, so you can get playtesting all over the world.
Oh, absolutely. I think being in lockdown in 2020 and parts of 2021, I think it led a lot of people to discover these online platforms. And a lot of people became more accepting of these because there was a certain stigma of it being like a video game, where really we want to play a board game. We want to have a tactile experience with other people around the table and have that sort of sense of community. So people were frowning upon the virtual platforms, but once you weren't able to physically meet with people and you were stuck inside your house, then those platforms kind of flourished. And now I think the publishers especially and the designers discovered the convenience of it. It is tremendous, because in the past, if I wanted someone in Europe to review my game, I would have to make a prototype and then ship it to Europe somewhere, and then hope that it gets there in one piece, hope that they will play, and hope that if they reject it, they would actually send it back. A lot of times you never see it or they never get it. So it was a very
expensive and time consuming. Yes.
Yeah. Not to mention there's always expense involved. I mean, the prototypes, you know, they can cost quite a bit. And so the shipping, so sending half dozen games around the world can add up to quite a bit over time.
You have created a variety of Euro style games. Can you explain how a Euro game might differ from an American style board game?
Sure thing. And before I say anything, I want to say that there's definitely a lot of ways that people like to define these genres. There's not really a completely agreed upon definition. But to me, and to a lot of people, a Euro game is a game that's a very structured, kind of rules-driven game, as opposed to something like a role-playing game where it's very free-flowing. You have basic framework, but then you're free to use your imagination and sort of act things out and change rules on the fly. Euro games also tend to have not a ton of negative player interaction, by which I mean things like warfare, eliminating people through combat or through other actions, kind of hurting people's ability to play the game. So a lot of them tend to be more of almost like a big puzzle with multiple ways to achieve your victory, and pretty set rules in place that allow you to sort of navigate this puzzle. And they come in large variety of shapes and sizes. So there isn't just one sort of type. Some even can be war game, appear like a war game, or appear like an economic game, or appear like a game about running a circus, or a game about running a zoo, or a game about building a hot air balloon. So it's all these different sort of themes that they can have, but they're united by this thinky kind of thinky structured game that appeals to a certain type of player.
Well,
and that also is very appealing to me. And so that's the genre that I tend to work in the most.
Let's take a call. Mark in Mineral Point. Mark, you're on with game designer Stan Kordonsky.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on the types of games. And the kind of thing that appeals to me a lot are these cooperative games where the players figure out how to work together strategically and creatively, you know, to achieve a goal. And a good example of this is a game called Rescuing Robin Hood. And of course, people know the classic story of Robin Hood. And there are all kinds of nuances of how people can figure out how to get, you know, Robin Hood out of jail. It's a game by Castillo Games.
Mark, thank you. Stan, what about cooperation in gaming?
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic. I don't have any games currently on the market that could be considered a fully cooperative experience, but I am working on one. I have been working on one for some time, and perhaps one day you guys will see a cooperative game from me, hopefully sooner than later. But yeah, I think it's a great genre. So it allows people who aren't terribly maybe good at games sometimes to enter the field, because if you have someone who is better at games, playing a competitive game is hard because you're either coaching people against yourself to win, or you're not helping them, and therefore they have not a great time because you're winning so much more against them because you're so much more experienced. But cooperative game, it sort of straddles that problem pretty well, where you can help someone because you are on the same team. So it's great for experienced players, of course, but it has this added bonus where I can invite you to a game night and you may be intimidated because you're not playing a lot of board games, maybe never played a board game. And I can say, don't worry, we're all playing together. We win or lose together. There is no pressure to beat us. There is no pressure. We're all in it against the game. And so I think that's the main appeal of cooperative games to myself and a lot of other people.
Well, Stan, happy game night, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stan Kordonsky founded a board game design and development studio in Milwaukee called Half a Kingdom Games. Ahead this hour, a Madison-based comics creator and board game illustrator reaches new milestones. We'll talk about it after this news update. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Wisconsin cartoonist, illustrator, and board game artwork industry icon John Kovalik is here, one of the designers behind the popular party game Apples to Apples. And since then, he's designed thousands of game characters for more than 100 games. Join in on his comic strip, Dork Tower, John's creative process, his doodles, more, 800-642-1234. John Kovalik, creator of the comic book and webcomic Dork Tower, now in its 25th anniversary. Welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much. I feel so old all of a sudden.
Well, explain the staying power of Dork Tower. Why has it endured, speaking of old?
Well, the comic strip is based on... centered around four friends who are gamers. And it started off as purely... a comic strip about games and gaming conventions and geekdom. It's become more of a social comic recently, especially since the start of the pandemic. But I think, you know, the whole nerd culture, geek culture, whatever you'd like to call it, has exploded over the last 20 years. And Dork Tower has just managed to surf that wave.
Do you have to know the ins and outs of Dungeons and Dragons to get to understand Dork Tower?
That's a 10th level question. you do not. In fact, especially not in such minutiae. It's more of a general audience sort of comic these days. I do some very gamer heavy comics for Dork Towers. For the game industry magazines that it runs in. But on the website, it tends to be more about relationships of the characters with the games and the gaming, a little bit more in the background.
Do you have a thing for muskrats? I mean, why not a badger?
Okay, so I was born in Manchester.
I'm so glad you give more context when I ask these goofy questions, so carry on.
I was born in Manchester, England, and I started cartooning when I was in school over here. I'm in London at the moment, just visiting my parents. I'll be back in Wisconsin in a few days. I was very much influenced by Charles Schulz when I was in school. And my first comic strip was something called Wildlife, which actually ran in the Wisconsin State Journal for a few years and was nationally syndicated briefly in the 1990s. But the main character was a muskrat named Carson. And growing up in England, I had never actually seen a muskrat. So one of the running gags in the strip is that, you know, Carson does not look very much like a muskrat. Carson has come over into Dork Tower. He's the one character from my old strip who made the leap. But I did have a badger in the old strip who didn't look very much like a badger. So when I came to Wisconsin for university, it was sort of more in place there.
You know, in this world of social media and instant gratification, I wonder how does the commentary you see online and those reactions inform what happens through your hands? How does it inform your cartooning and your illustrating?
I try to come up with a comic strip relatively organically, just, you know, sketching first, then drawing it out. And I will pay attention to what people are saying online. I'll pay particular attention to what my readers are saying on Patreon, because they're all paying money to keep the comic going. So there's the big social crowdfunding aspect of cartooning these days as well. But, you know, you try not to let the good or the bad influence you too much, you know, to change a direction or change a topic. If I've got a cartoon I'm not sure about, I'll run it past the folks on the Patreon page first and get their reaction overall. But normally, you know, I've got a pretty good idea of what I want to say in a comic, what I'm trying to say in a comic, and, you know, they might help me more focus the idea than actually providing any ideas themselves.
Talking with John Kovalik, comic creator, illustrator for more than 100 games. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Nathan is with us in Madison. Nathan, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for having me. So I have a question that kind of spans the two worlds of your previous guest and this guest, which is, you know, as a kid, I remember there was a game company that sold games with literally no pieces. They had no money, no poker chips or anything, because they knew you had all that stuff lying at home. And nowadays on stuff like Kickstarter, you have these huge extravagant games with painted miniatures and buildings it comes with and everything. And I'm curious, you know, as a member, as someone who's big in the art section of the games industry and a gamer in general, John, what do you think of that balance between game design and game production for attracting people on crowdfunding sources?
That's interesting. Okay, so you're talking about Cheap Ass Games, which was run by my good friend James Ernest for several years, which came with, again, you know, no money, no tokens, no dice, because it just assumed people had those at home. It's really interesting because obviously the biggest selling game I ever worked on was Apples to Apples. And I get a lot of guff from my friends in the industry because, you know, they will say, well, yeah, you illustrated one apple on that game. On the other hand, there's a game like Munchkin, which I've worked on for now 20 years. And in the various Munchkin iterations, that's now spanned something like, I stopped counting when I got to about 7,500 Munchkin cards that I have drawn. And, you know, it's really, you can't really pin down any kind of correlation. Like, it depends on the game. I love some of the Kickstarter games with these gorgeous pieces. I recently got the Wacky Races game, and it's just beautiful with all these little cartoon miniatures that you push around the board. And then you'll have some super serious games, which have got very little illustration, very few illustrations in them. So it really just depends on the game and what the designer and the art director and the artist are going for with that game.
Nathan, as you span gaming and the art world, what games do you see as beautiful in your eye?
Well, obviously I do love John's art. I don't want to dismiss the joy of speaking with him. That's great. But yeah, I am a sucker for those miniatures and stuff you talked about. You mentioned earlier in the show, Return to Dark Tower, and it came with many, many lovely little miniatures that there's a simple joy of pushing those things around the board. Even if the game might not be as polished as it needs to, the miniatures can make up that gap.
And you see, I think that's a really good point about the success board games have had recently, because, and obviously this went down a bit during the pandemic, but there is a very tactile sense of delight that comes from sitting around a table with your friends, pushing pieces around the board or pushing miniature tanks across a pretend battlefield, or just holding a hand of cards and, you know, watching your friends' reactions as you play a card on them. That's something which, you know, the online gaming world is great. It's terrific. It's a wonderful space for the most part, but you just don't get that very palpable, tactile sense of moving something around.
I wonder, John, you know, as co-founder, co-owner of Out of the Box Games, you mentioned Apples to Apples sold millions of copies. What is that? What is your creative process of illustrating for games versus illustrating, you know, comic books or cartoons?
That's interesting because I'm just finishing a game for a French company. And at the start of the process, it's a lovely game. I don't believe it's been announced yet. It's by one of my very favorite game designers. But at the start of the process, I was trying to come up with a whole new style for the game. And I was completely overthinking it. And then I essentially realized that, well, they came to me because they want my style, you know, my very relatively simple Peanuts-influenced, you know, line drawings. And so I just did a 180 degree turn. I went back to that, and I've been enjoying it immensely since then. But you know, there's not a whole amount of difference. The size of a Munchkin card illustration will be about the size of a Dark Tower panel. I use the same pens. I use the same paper. I'll scan them in the same. I will color them using Photoshop. So there's not really a great deal of difference. I mean, I try with a game, I try to see the designer's vision. I try to help the game along. I try to add things in the background that the game rules might mention. But other than that, it's a very similar process for both.
Sounds
I'll
like
do the comic strip in the morning and game illustrations in the afternoon.
What do you do in the middle of the night then?
I worry about cartoons and games.
So when do you do your best work? Seriously, how you know? Because a lot of creatives might have a particular place or time when they can really get into flow.
Yes. Early in the morning, I think, is when I do my best. If I'm really on my game, I'll wake up around 5:30 and I'll be drawing by 6. By mid-afternoon, if I want to get any work done, it tends to have to be busy work, you know, checking emails, replying to emails, getting some office organization, getting books in the mail, things of that nature.
John Kovalik, creator of Dark Tower comic books, comic strips, web comics, a peek inside his world, illustrating more than 100 tabletop games. Join in on his work, the creative process of illustrating, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. What a pleasure to be in conversation with Wisconsin cartoonist, illustrator, and writer John Kovalik. Join in on your favorite comic strips of his, your Dork Tower takeaways, ideas you have for him for illustrating, perhaps, the humor, the wit that shines through in the card game Munchkin, or illustrations that you just didn't get. 800-642-1234. John Kovalik stays with us. So, John, I want to go a little deeper on characters, because sometimes dorks and geeks, they're not treated nicely in school. They can be bullied. And, you know, Igor in particular throws himself into every comic and craze and hobby with brimming with enthusiasm. How does being an outsider, perhaps, or being othered manifest at all in Dork Tower?
Okay, that speaks to some of the social strips I've been doing recently, more than the geek strips. At the moment, this is very much a golden age of geekdom. And so you know, it's I don't worry too much about that aspect. Kids in my child's school all play board games. It's very different from when I went to school. I literally had the very first, I beg your pardon, the second edition of Dungeons and Dragons when it was in a little white box. And nobody had ever heard of it before. Nobody knew what the heck was going on. And now, you know, there are Dungeons and Dragons clubs It's one of the after-school activities my child can partake in. They just went to nerd summer camp. But, you know,
Did you lead it?
No. it was some of her friends, you know, knew who I was. And I kind of want to stay in the background from those sorts of situations. but it's something just really fun. It's delightful to see. It absolutely is. And, you know, there was stereotype of the jocks and the nerds. And it turns out that many of these jocks are also nerds. There's a story about the Green Bay Packers a couple of years ago, and I believe they were playing Settlers of Catan.
The two can come together, the two worlds. But what about Igor, the Tao of Igor, poking fun, but mostly celebrating locally organized fan conventions for comic books and games? Is Igor someone after your own heart?
No, Igor. Okay, so the Tao of Igor is the first new Dork Tower collection in just over a decade. I got caught up in being a dad and also in a lot of game illustrations. Munchkin really took off during this period, and there's just a lot of work. But Igor is one of the favorite, one of the most popular characters in Dork Tower. And he is based directly on my friend Scott, who was in my D&D group in the 1990s. And I actually have
Dungeons and Dragons,
downplay.
Just, you know.
Yeah, please.
Carry on.
I actually have to downplay Igor, because the real Scott will do crazier things in a game, and he will throw himself into things far more than Igor does. And I had to make Igor at least a little bit believable. So he's tempered a bit.
What do you like about him as a character?
Oh, his positivity, enthusiasm, joy of life, always looking on the bright side, always being a supporter. Just a wonderful, crazy character. And, you know, Scott remains that way. And I try to reflect that in the character of Igor. It's just, he can be a little bit oblivious to what's going on around him. And the storyline of the Tao of Igor is Igor actually running, yes, a local comics and games convention. It was just fun throwing him into that situation. It was like you're tossing a hand grenade and what happens.
And who shows up, I would imagine.
Yes.
Jack from Madison called, couldn't stay with us. And Jack suggests that you create a comic strip character like Tintin, who is Wisconsin based. And could it possibly be a political parody? Can you run with that?
That sounds a little bit more like Pogo than Tintin from the politics side. I used to be the editorial cartoonist at the Wisconsin State Journal. And getting out of politics was one of the sanest decisions I believe I've ever made. Even though, like, as I said, social situations, sometimes politics will pop up in the Dork Tower webcomic. I don't have to deal with it any more than just watching on the news anymore. And that's joyous.
It seems like you split your brain in different directions, and maybe that's kind of the life of an illustrator, the life of an artist, having to really go where the work takes you, but also your creative process is, I would imagine, a North Star. How do you make that strike that balance?
It's actually quite tough. Before, in the old days, when I was at the State Journal, I also wrote food reviews and music reviews and just the general illustrations, as well as the editorial cartoons. And my brain, for a brain that doesn't shift gears well, I can be surprisingly easily distracted. And those distractions are often what will make for a good cartoon. Just a very random idea will pop into my mind. Whereas the illustration aspect is definitely more focused and certainly more of a mindful approach. to illustrating, to drawing 160 cards for a Munchkin game, or designing new characters for a game about the Holy Grail or such like.
John Kovalik with us about his life and times as a comics and board game illustrator. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. John, talking about Ukraine, the invasion of Ukraine, you created this poster for charity that shows Paddington Bear representing the president of Ukraine and facing a much larger Russian bear. What inspired you to create that poster?
I was about a week after the invasion, I believe. And I was just, it was late at night and I was sitting at my drawing table. And I read that the president of Ukraine was the voice actor for Paddington in the two Paddington movies that were released in the Ukraine. And growing up in England, I've been a huge Paddington fan since as long as I could remember. And this image just automatically, out of nowhere, popped in my head of Paddington giving one of his very hard stares, keeping this giant Russian bear in check. And going back to your question about social media, I posted this on Twitter almost immediately. I just took a picture of it, posted it. And right away, people started offering to buy it, to donate the money to charity. So I did a better drawing of it. We turned it into a poster. And we have sold hundreds of those posters around the world. And we've raised over $10,000 for World Central Kitchens, the amazing organization Chef Jose Andres has founded, and who are on the ground in Ukraine, on the Ukrainian border, feeding thousands of people. So that was just inspiring, and it seemed a very good place to send money to.
That's a beautiful story, and thank you for sharing your talent. Just as we wrap here, only a few seconds left, what do you do if you have just, you know, you can't draw, or if your brain just won't get it right? Do you ever, you know, have that encounter?
Yes. and coffee often helps, sometimes maybe something stronger, but in all seriousness, you try to work ahead enough so that you've got ideas to fall back on, even if nothing new is coming up that particular day.
That's a good advice for life. John, thank you for joining us. What a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure.
John Kovalik, comic artist, game illustrator based in the Madison area. Earlier, we talked with international board game developer in Milwaukee, Stanislav Kordonsky. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.